Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. I am delighted to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Arun Gupta, who is a co-founder of the Independent magazine. That's independent with a Y. Independent.org is the website, and who was a co-founder of the Occupy Wall Street Journal. He is a contributor to The Progressive, The Guardian, and In These Times magazine. Arun Gupta, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Great to be with you.
So I wanted to have you on to talk about a couple of great articles you wrote that caught my eye in recent weeks. One is in the May issue of The Progressive magazine, and it's called Little Baghdad, California. Where and what is Little Baghdad, California?
Well, Little Baghdad is basically El Cajon, California. This is the bedroom community of San Diego, east of the city, nestled in the foothills, the mountains out there. It's a semi-arid desert-like climate, and it's one of the largest Iraqi-American communities, the second largest in the United States. And in fact, it has the most refugees who have come over as a result of the 2003 war. In the last 5 years, it's estimated something like 15,000, perhaps more, refugees have settled in El Cajon. And this is a city of only 100,000. So, you know, this would be like something like 1.2 million refugees settling in New York in a five-year period. So it's very much changed the character of this town. And I had come across it last year when I was covering the story about the murder of Shema Alawadi. She was an Iraqi-American woman who was killed in her home, and a note was left back next to her body that said, "Go back to your country, you terrorist." And it was And this became a big story, an international story, because it was thought it was some hate crime. But about 6 months later, her husband was arrested in conjunction with it. But when I got there, I was struck by, you go downtown, and there's a large section of it, and that's what's called Little Baghdad, where many of the stores have Arabic sign language, where it's all these Middle Eastern groceries, restaurants, jewelry stores, cafes. You see a lot of Middle Eastern people walking around. And I was just struck because I'd been writing so much about the Iraq War for many years, and I was very familiar with the situation of the refugees as a result of the U.S. occupation and invasion that started in 2003. It's estimated anywhere from 3 to 5 million Iraqis were displaced. And this is just an enormous number, because you're talking about a population of only 27 million. So anywhere from something like 11% to 18% of the population was made into refugees. And I was wondering, how did so many of them wind up in the desert of Southern California? And so I decided to come back and look into that story.
But we should be clear, of those 3 to 5 million, only a small fraction have come to the United States, correct?
Yes. Of the Iraqis who've been displaced, about half are displaced inside the country. Then a lot have been gone to Syria or Jordan or Turkey, or made their way to Europe. And the U.S., the Bush administration, pretty much refused to let in any refugees initially. So for the first 3 years, it only let in a total of 700 Iraqi refugees. Because if it started letting in all these displaced people, it would have essentially been an admission that the occupation was a failure. So finally, it started to become so much of a crisis, especially for the tens of thousands of Iraqis who worked for the U.S. occupation, for the military, as translators or all the various U.S. contractors that were involved in the disastrous reconstruction. They were being threatened for collaborating with the occupation. So Congress passed that in January 2008, Bush signs the Refugee Crisis in Iraq Act. As he's out, going out the door, finally the door opens to Iraqi refugees. So since then, about 80,000 Iraqis have been let into the United States. you know, it's not insubstantial, but we're talking maybe only about 2 to 3% of those who've been displaced, who've lost their homes, who've often lost loved ones to the conflict, you know, who are certainly traumatized. It's only a small percentage who've been let into the U.S. Most of those who have been let in are Chaldean Catholics. Iraq has a significant Christian community. It's about 500,000 to 1 million, according to various estimates. So reasonably large, but still a minority. And the Chaldeans, they're one of 22 Catholic rites, so they're technically part of the Roman Catholic Church. They were essentially the merchants in Iraq. Many of them had businesses. They were the only ones who were allowed to have liquor stores. So there was a perception that if you were a Chaldean, you had money. So they very much became a target of kidnappers, of gang mafias that rose up after the U.S. invaded and occupied. And then because they were also relatively small, they're only a few percent of the population, they also started to be targeted by religious extremists. So this has led to hundreds of thousands of Chaldeans to flee. And that's mainly who's coming into the U.S., especially El Cajon. The way the refugee resettlement process works is the State Department wants to resettle refugees with relatives, and there has been a Chaldean community in El Cajon for over 50 years. And there's also the largest Iraqi community is in Michigan, in the Detroit Dearborn area, but the State Department didn't want to settle so many there, so it's been sending them to El Cajon. So that's how come you get this large influx. And then you also get all the people all who worked for the occupation. And in fact, I met a group of seven friends. They all lived in Babil province, which is just south of Baghdad, seven guys in their 20s, 30s. All of them worked for the U.S. Occupation in one capacity or another. There were like mechanical engineers and IT specialists. One was a security guard named Nabil, and he worked for the Research Triangle Institute. Now, the Research Triangle Institute was paid $500 million by the U.S. government to try to sow democracy, but, you know, as we can see, it didn't exactly work out. And Nabil was a security guard, and he said he survived a three-car bombing, and he was rather nonchalant about it. He was just like, I was lucky. And I asked him why he left Iraq, and he only left about half a year ago. And he said people were coming up to him on the street and telling him, you know, we're going to kill you, we're going to kill your son and family, you know, because he had worked for the occupation. He was seen by many as a collaborator. But he said, you know, it's also just the lack of public services. Iraq is destroyed. We take things for granted here, like electricity, but and in Iraq, the electricity is incredibly erratic. It's often out many hours of the day. You don't have it. You don't know when you're going to have it. And if you don't have electricity, you don't have any type of modern amenities, right? You don't have light. You don't have computers or phones. You don't have refrigeration. You don't have water, so that means you don't have sewage or plumbing, you don't have air conditioning. It basically makes it impossible to live. You're reduced to this pre-industrial lifestyle. And people say, you know, it's bad enough that you don't have all these services, but you go out, whether it's to the work or the market or school, and you don't know if you're going to die in a car bomb or some sort of sectarian attack or by a death squad. And this is basically the reality that's been left behind by the United States. And so the Iraqis continue to flee their country and continue to come over. But Nabil said, you know, because he worked for the Research Triangle Institute and he lost his country, he lost his homeland, and he was forced to flee, he thought he would get a warm welcome, a hero's welcome over here, and be set up with a, you know, decent job and a good apartment. He said, you know, I thought when I came to the United States, I would be better than the prime minister of Iraq. He said, now I'm jealous of the street cleaner because he's unemployed. He's living on welfare, as are most of the refugees who've come over. Once they do come over to the United States, they are put into the welfare system. And, you know, as everyone knows, we have one of the worst welfare systems in the world. So for a couple, a childless couple, you get about $500 a month in cash. You get food stamps, about $350 a month, and then you're put on Medicaid. And that's just impossible to live on. So they're trying to get jobs, and the pressure is also on immediately to get jobs. But the fact of the matter is the economy is so terrible, especially a place like El Cajon. The unemployment rate is 11%. The poverty rate is 23%. The type of jobs they can get are the jobs that no Americans want. So it's things like working in a fast food restaurant or become parking lot attendant. And, you know, you have to understand this is a very well-educated population that's coming over. Iraq was a highly educated country up until, you know, the sanctions era in the 90s, and then the war really destroyed a lot of the educational infrastructure. But many of the Iraqis who come over, you know, they're older in their 40s, 50s, 60s. They're doctors, lawyers, accountants, you know, computer specialists, all sorts of engineers that I talked to. And one of the social workers was saying, you know, when you meet them, she's like, you see their faces and they're so proud of their work experience. They're so proud of their degrees. And then you tell them you have to clean 16 hotel rooms a day, and they just look destroyed. You know, that this is what they've been reduced to. But in many ways, they're the lucky ones. The jobless rate among adult refugees is at 67%. Among those over 45, it's 85%. So basically only one out of seven has been able to get a job, you know, because a lot of them are fluent in English, but nonetheless, you know, they have an accent. They don't know the cultural norms. They don't have any social networks over here. And so they're basically, many of them are living in squalor. They're living in these dingy apartments. You know, you have five, six, seven people crammed into a one-bedroom apartment living on food stamps. And for many, Nabil and his friends are basically, you know, it's we're living for our children. So it's a pretty miserable situation, and many of them feel betrayed. You know, first they lost their country because of the U.S., and now they come here, and they basically don't have any sort of life or any real future prospect.
We're speaking with Arun Gupta about his article in the May issue of The Progressive, Little Baghdad, California. Arun, the layers of bitter irony in this story seem to pile up. You have San Diego, where Bush stood on an aircraft carrier and declared mission accomplished, 10 years later, welcoming the fleeing Christians from what many in the U.S. military thought of as a Christian war on Muslims, fleeing the liberated country, and the collaborators who helped with the U.S. occupation fleeing that country and coming to the United States, the land of their dreams, and being bitterly disappointed. And in fact, you mention in the article some instances of Iraqi refugees running into U.S. domestic violence and in fact getting shot on the streets of Oakland rather than the streets of Baghdad.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's a pretty bad situation. I mean, I do want to, you know, emphasize that these people are survivors, right? And so they've managed to make it over, and many of them are doing what it takes. But, you know, it was really surprising to me that, you know, how horrible Iraq is. A number of them said, you know, if I'd known how it was going to be over here, I wouldn't have left, despite the violence, despite the lack of public services. Now in Northern California, the community there is somewhat different. It tends to be a lot of their families, but there are also a lot of single men who come over. And the situation there is even worse, you know, because your payment is all based on how many people you have in your household. So if you're a single male, you're getting just a couple hundred, $200-$300 a month in cash, and you're supposed to live on this. And the way the resettlement works is the refugee agencies, they put them in basically the cheapest places they can find because they're being paid. They're getting such little support. And so in the Bay Area, this means some of the poorest, most crime-ridden parts of Oakland. And so you'll have like 4 to 5 single Iraqi men who are living in a one-bedroom apartment. They're just making, you know, getting a couple $100 a month, and then they get food stamps. One person indicated to me that a lot of them have taken to basically selling the food stamps, right? You'll go to the store with someone else, and you buy their groceries with your food stamps, and then they'll give you cash in exchange. So this is how they try to make a little extra money to be able to survive. But, you know, many of them have been mugged. It's not uncommon. You know, they don't know the norms. They don't know the bus system. You know, you don't know essentially where it's safe and not safe to walk around your neighborhood at night. And a couple of years ago, one refugee, he was shot and paralyzed on the streets of Oakland. You know, and this is, you know, it's quite a bitter irony that he survived the U.S. invasion. He survived the sectarian war. He was able to flee his country, but it's on in the streets of the U.S. that he's essentially disabled for life. In talking to everyone I talked to, really felt like, you know, the U.S. Really owes this community something, that there's a lot more they can and should be doing for them. And, you know, seeing how these refugees live, it's certainly true. I mean, the United States is a rich country, as we know, and especially if you go throughout California, there's an enormous amount of wealth in California. And there's no reason that we couldn't be doing much more for these refugees. And of course, everyone who was harmed by the Iraq War, we could be doing a lot more for the veteran as well. It's a political choice not to do so.
Well, you don't read a lot or hear a lot about Iraqi refugees in the U.S. corporate media, the fraction of them that are here in the U.S. Or the millions elsewhere in the world. And so I appreciate your writing about this topic. And you wrote, Arun, about one of the top individuals responsible for what was done to the nation of Iraq, David Petraeus. You wrote an article in the GC Advocate called "The Trouble with Professor Petraeus." First of all, since when is he a professor?
He was just appointed a couple of weeks ago. He's going to be a professor at the City University of New York at the Macaulay Honors College starting August 1st, 2013. I understand he's also got an appointment at the University of Southern California. I haven't confirmed that by someone else, but I was really quite flabbergasted when I saw this, because you know, when you Petraeus is a war criminal, right? That's not a pejorative. That's just simply a statement of fact, and you expect that from the Ivy League colleges. You know, Harvard is notorious for appointing war criminals, both the U.S. and international ones, to its faculty. But the City University of New York is really one of the storied premier public education institutions, and just for many decades has been really a shining example of the best in progressive public education. And so for Petraeus to be appointed as a professor, especially when the chancellor said, you know, he praised him for his leadership qualities and for his experience that he will impart to the students in things like security, intelligent matters, and nation building, I thought to myself, this is some sort of a sick joke. You know, everyone knows that Petraeus resigned last November as director of the CIA after his affair with his biographer Paula Broadwell became public. As CIA director, he was in charge of their drone program, and he endorsed the signature strike program. And this is really this unbelievably Orwellian program where the U.S. is targeting people based on patterns of behavior. I saw one person refer to it as pre-crime, and then said, "Well, it's not even really pre-crime, because they're not even planning on committing a crime. It's basically, if you're a male in areas of Afghanistan or Pakistan, and you may live in a particular region, you know, you may be near some event, you're then considered a target, and they know nothing about you. This is just all based on the observation from these drones, and then you get obliterated. It's this state-sponsored murder of innocents, and Petraeus was in charge of this. But before this, he really first comes to prominence back in 2004. Petraeus served as part of the invasion force as a general of a division, I believe, in the airborne division. And then in 2003, and then in 2004, he's assigned to be head of training operations for all Iraqi security forces. He takes over in the summer of 2004. Now, previously, in April of 2004, there were two uprisings. One was among the Sunni community. This was sparked by the incident where the Blackwater mercenaries went into Fallujah. Four of them were killed, and the U.S. essentially started leveling the city, and this sparked a Sunni uprising throughout much of Iraq. There had already been an insurgency, but it really accelerated to another level. And then in Baghdad, the U.S. tried to arrest this populist cleric, Muqtada al-Sadr, who is a Shia cleric, and so that created another uprising. And in April of 2004, if folks remember, it really looked like for a period that the occupation was on the ropes. And it came out afterwards that the country had erupted in such tremendous violence, you know, the U.S. couldn't even run convoys anymore, that it was considering evacuating the Green Zone because it didn't know how it was going to resupply its personnel inside of there. And at that time, the Iraqi security forces that had been set up completely collapsed. Many of them refused to fight. Many of them deserted or even mutinied. And so Petraeus was given the assignment of training about 300,000 security forces, all police, all the military, all intelligence services, over a dozen different security forces. And so they start setting up this training program. But at the same time, the U.S. had installed basically this ex-Baathist, this former associate of Saddam Hussein, who is also a close CIA asset, Iyad Alawi, as prime minister. They had undertaken a specific strategy that was reported in the media at the time and some of the specialty media like Jane's Intelligence Digest, where they were going to basically use ex-Baathists to hunt down the insurgents because many of the insurgents had been, you know, in the Saddam Hussein's security and intelligence services. That's how they had the skills and the networks to be able to fight the U.S. occupation effectively. So Petraeus is given, put in charge of this. What he decides pretty quickly is to set up these militias, the most infamous of which was known as the Special Police Commandos. And these militias, Petraeus admits that he gives them all sorts of money. They're given training. They're given weapons, vehicles, whatever they need. And these militias essentially become part of what's known as the Salvador option. This is a reference to the dirty war in El Salvador in the 1980s, where 70,000 civilians were killed by the U.S.-backed right-wing government. The U.S. had hundreds of special forces personnel in the country who were heavily involved in training the death squad there. And in fact, one of the individuals, a colonel, Colonel James Steele, who served in El Salvador and also served in Colombia while its U.S.-backed dirty war was going on, was on Petraeus' staff. And so these militias start to surface in 2005. And basically, accusations start coming out right away, and not just accusations, but all sorts of evidence that they're engaging in mass arrests, torture. They have a television show, a reality television show called Terrorism in the Grip of Justice, where they parade these alleged insurgents on the TV and elicit confessions. But, you know, many people say that they suspects, they all look like they're beaten. Their faces are bruised. They look like they're being coached off camera as they're giving confessions. And they're always Sunni, these insurgents. And they're admitting to just these wild allegations and crimes that they're in the mosques. And this is what they're actually saying, that they're watching pornography. They're having drunken gay orgies. That it basically is presenting the Sunnis as a bunch of thieving scumbags. And this show was very popular among the Shia and Kurdish communities. So it really starts to stoke kind of a lot of sectarian antagonism. where the Sunni community feels like it's being targeted by, at that point in 2005, a new government is elected as part of the occupation as a Shia-led government. And so the Sunni community really starts to feel it's being targeted by these militias. Then all these reports start coming out. These suspects who appear on the television show, their bodies turn up a few days later. Then other reports start to surface of mass arrests of Sunnis, you know, 5 here, 10 here, a dozen there. Their bodies start to turn up later. And reporters who gain access to the offices of these special police commandos say that there's torture going on in their systematic torture. The Guardian reported that the special police commandos in Baghdad alone had 14 torture centers. And in their main headquarters, their torture center was on the 7th floor. Meanwhile, the American personnel were on the 8th floor. And The Guardian also just had a series of exposés in the last couple of months where it was able to talk to some of the Iraqi generals who were in charge of the special police commandos who ended up fleeing Iraq because their lives were threatened, and who said, you know, the Americans knew exactly what was going on. They were present. They approved of everything. And in fact, also in June of 2004, as the U.S. was transferring power, the military issued this order that said if American forces saw Iraqis committing torture or other war crimes, it could report it, but that would be the end of it. There was to be no investigation. So basically, it was the U.S. was setting all the conditions in 2004 to start a dirty war against the Sunni-based insurgency. And Petraeus was in charge of this. And so now we can fast forward to 2013, and in the last month, Iraq has been teetering on the brink of civil war because the sectarian militias are still very much alive. The Sunni community has been targeted viciously by the Iraqi government, and there was a protest movement that was going on for many months. Then a few weeks ago, Iraqi military forces attacked one of these protest camps, killing dozens of Sunni protesters, and open warfare started to break out, and hundreds have died since then. And this is all part of Petraeus' legacy, because he's the one who decided to set up, to back, to arm, and train these death squads.
In fact, Arun, there are those arguing that Iraq is in worse shape now post-intervention than Syria is pre-intervention. Petraeus clearly guilty of murder and torture and God knows what else, but brought down for adultery because we do have some standards. And he's the star of a new video game, and he is a professor in our institutions of higher learning. And we are out of time, but I am very, very grateful to you, Arun Gupta, for reporting on these issues and for coming on Talk Nation Radio. Arun Gupta is the co-founder of The Independent. Go to Independent with a Y in Indy, independent.org magazine, and he was a co-founder of the Occupy Wall Street Journal. Arun, thanks for being on Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks for having me on, and folks can find all my work at OccupyUSAToday.com. That's OccupyUSAToday.com.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.